You're listening to a CNA podcast.
Does the name Boris Nadezhdin ring a bell? Maybe not. And Russian President Vladimir Putin wants to keep it that way. Russia heads to the polls this weekend, and the anti-war Mr. Nadezhdin was the only serious opponent in the running.
Ничего на свете лучше нету.
This is one of his social media posts. He's playing the guitar, belting out a patriotic song with his daughter. And as they sing, images of lengthy queues flash across the screen, showing hundreds of people lining up in the snow to register their support for him. But he was disqualified last month. Officials said he didn't have enough signatures to back his bid. I'm Teresa Tang. This week, we turn our attention to Russia as we try to understand President Putin's grip on power and its impact on the more than 143 million people who call the nation home. Former Moscow correspondent Julia Chapman joins me today. Hey, Julia, thanks for coming on.
My pleasure. Very happy to be with you.
Now, you have a very special fascination with Russia. I know you spent 5 years there, part of it as a correspondent, and you speak Russian as well. Tell me, what draws you to this country?
I think, as so often is the case with these kinds of things, there's a family connection. I'm not Russian, despite my name, but my mum is Eastern European. And I always kind of had an eye on that part of the world, was always interested in what was going on there. And when I decided to become a journalist, Russia sort of seemed like the obvious place to start. It was the country with the most international interest. It was an unknown quantity for so many people. And I think what I liked about it was that it seemed like a bit of a challenge. And so I decided to start learning Russian. And the more I picked up and the more Russian people I spoke to, the more I started to kind of fall in love, not just with the politics, but also the culture, the language, the food, and probably more than anything, the landscape, the really varied landscape. It's the biggest country in the world, and it's just endlessly fascinating. And as a journalist, when I started working there, you know, I very quickly realized that it's never boring. There's always something going on, something that's often very shocking to the outside world. And, you know, for many people, I think they see Russia as a country that's very dangerous to be a journalist in. And when I first arrived, I didn't really feel that, at least not as a Western correspondent. Certainly, the government didn't love having Western journalists, foreign journalists, scrutinizing its actions, but mostly it was worried about what people were reporting on in the Russian language. And so there was certainly a fairly free rein. We had, wasn't being followed. We may not have had very much access to government officials, but we could really go about our lives doing what we wanted to do. And the Russian people, we always found, were actually very open. They were always happy for a chat. You could stop someone on the street and ask them what they thought about politics, and they may not necessarily give you a fully honest answer. They might be afraid of the consequences, but they were always very happy to talk to you. And that was something I really enjoyed about working in Russia. And it wasn't really until the full-scale invasion of Ukraine that that changed and I started to feel more vulnerable.
You are typically based in London, but right now you're on assignment in Budapest. And I know you were based in Moscow for a few years and you left in 2022, not long after the so-called special military operation in Ukraine began. Julia, before things escalated, how would you describe President Putin's presence in Russia? I was reading one poll putting his approval rating at an astounding 80%. Just how popular is he? Did you get the sense that he loomed over daily life?
It's certainly a question that's difficult to come up with an entirely fact-based answer for. Of course, polling is not completely independent. Even the independent pollsters are now operating under such restrictions that you can't really get a clear answer about what people think anymore. They're too afraid of the repercussions. But back in the day where it was a bit more possible to gauge public opinion, I wouldn't say that Putin looms over the country. There are certainly many, many supporters of Vladimir Putin. I think it's impossible to overstate that. There are people who think that he has done wonders for the country. He's lifted it out of poverty. There are also many Russians who view the West with a lot of suspicion, and they are very sympathetic to the ideas put forward by Vladimir Putin that the West is out to get Russia, that it's constantly seeking to punish Russia. There is a lot of sympathy with that as well. So that rhetoric does play into quite a lot of sentiment publicly in Russia. There are then segments of society that are a bit skeptical about Putin himself, but don't really see any viable alternatives. They don't feel that he's taking their country down a particularly risky path. And then there's the segment of society that is vehemently anti-Putin. Those people come in different guises. They won't necessarily always be explicit or vocal about their feelings. Many of them are too afraid to express them. Then there are those that we did see taking to the streets in protest from time to time when it was more possible to do so. But there's also a huge part of Russian society, I think, that doesn't want to engage in politics, that doesn't really feel strongly about Putin, or even if they do, they don't feel that they have any power to change the way that he runs the country. So they just keep their head down and try to live their lives as much as they can, as freely as they can, and try to enjoy what they have without trying to get involved in politics. The media landscape is heavily restricted. It has become much more so since the war in Ukraine, the invasion in 2022, when every single independent Russian language media outlet was shut down. Wow. They are now operating outside of the country. So there are still sources of information, but they're much harder to access inside Russia now.
Now, the presidential election, it's just around the corner, and observers are saying, look, we already know who the winner is going to be. You know, Mr. Putin has already been either president or prime minister since the last day of 1999. And if he wins this time, he could potentially lead until 2036. That's another 12 years. Is this election just a formality, Julia?
I think it is. It's definitely a formality in the sense that, yes, there is a foregone conclusion. We know that Vladimir Putin is going to win. For President Putin himself, I think he sees this as a legitimizing exercise. It is important for him to show the world and to show the Russian people that he has a mandate. This is not a democracy in the sense that we would understand it in many parts of the world. This is very much a managed country where the idea of opposition is kind of fabricated. Even the candidates that are on the ballot alongside Vladimir Putin are ones that have the tacit approval of the Kremlin. And I think the point of holding these exercises is not only to show that Putin has support, but also to show that there is a lack of alternatives. And that is something that we've seen develop over the course of Vladimir Putin's tenure. We've seen Alexei Navalny attempt to run for president and be blocked from doing so back in 2018. Everybody who is on the ballot, as I say, is a managed opposition candidate. So for President Putin, he wants to say not only does he have the support, but he's the only person who could have that support. And for him, I think the real thing to watch, although there are many reasons why it's also a slightly artificial figure, is the turnout. There's one pollster that's a state-run pollster, Vitsiom, is estimating that turnout could be as high as 80%, which would be a really high number. Mm-hmm. That will be something that President Putin is obviously going to point to, but that should also be contextualized with the fact that state-run employees are forced to vote, so they will be bused to the polls by their employers. And so that is something to consider as well. And there are also many people who feel pressured to vote, even if they're not explicitly forced to do so. So yes, it is really just a formality, a box-checking exercise. But the interesting thing, I think, also to bear in mind is that when Alexei Navalny was still alive, he didn't actually call for Russians to boycott the vote. He did suggest that they still continue to go, but rather to vote for anybody other than Putin, to put their name behind the second most likely candidate to win, the smart voting tactic, as he called it. And that was something that had some limited success in certain parts of the country. But so even though we know what's going to happen, it is very much controlled. There are still voices in the country who believe it is a worthwhile exercise to go the polls and cast your ballot.
Yeah, it makes you wonder how many votes Nadyezhdin would have garnered had he been allowed to run in this election. Okay, so when Russians head to the polls and there is effectively only one option on that ballot, what issues are they considering? You know, how invested are they in the war in Ukraine, for example, or are other things more top of mind for them?
The war in Ukraine will loom large, certainly, over this election. I think there are definitely people who are concerned about the prospect of a second round of mobilization. That was something that was deeply unpopular when it was announced in September 2022. We did see protests, notably among segments of society we wouldn't necessarily have seen protesting before. So that's going to be something that people are keen to make their voices heard about. But there are also really more kind of intrinsic concerns about the economy. You know, despite all the rhetoric we hear from Vladimir Putin about the fact that the economy is doing well, that it has sanction-proofed itself, that it's growing, which it is, but it's growing from a very low base and it's growing much less than we would have expected it to had the war in Ukraine not happened. There is still a pretty high poverty rate in Russia, which President Putin acknowledged himself in his recent Federal Assembly address. It's a 9% poverty rate. It's much higher for large families, which was something he's very concerned about. He wants to see the birth rate go up. So he has been offering measures to the Russian people to try to incentivize them to have more children. So the economy is certainly very high on many people's minds. We've seen, you know, tax breaks and preferential mortgages announced recently as a kind of pre-election sweetener. And, you know, people that our colleagues have been speaking to on the ground in Moscow have really pointed to the fact that they want to see family prioritized and the stability of the country. And those are some of the things they say that they're going to be voting on at this election.
Strengthening support of the family, strengthening the workforce potential are the key issues. If there are people and they are strong and well, then the territories and cities will develop and the country will develop as well.
I think the emphasis should be on education, healthcare, and on family support. That's really key.
And so there are going to be a lot of challenges that Russians are facing this year. We have seen a country where the kind of economic impact has been shielded to a certain extent. The Russian people have been shielded from seeing the economic impact of sanctions. The government has really taken pains to try to mitigate those impacts on people's daily lives. But of course, inflation has been pretty high in Russia. It's falling now, but it's kind of stabilizing. It's not falling as much as the central bank would like to see. And we are also likely to see an impact of the lack of gas demand from Russia. International gas exports have subsidized the domestic prices for a really long time. So energy prices in Russia have always been really, really cheap for Russians. Mm. That's likely to change now because we saw last year that Gazprom, the state energy, the state gas company, suffered losses of 40%. And that means that there's a lot less headroom for those earnings to supplement and subsidize the domestic gas intake. So we're going to see those prices go up. That's going to make things a little bit harder for Russian people, and they'll certainly be thinking about that as they go to the polls.
One thing that hasn't gone unnoticed is that anyone who poses any sort of political threat to President Putin seems to face an untimely end. You know, there was the leader of the Wagner Group, mercenary force Yevgeny Prigozhin. He led a failed mutiny and his plane crashed shortly after. And then just last month, you know, you talk about Navalny, the opposition activist. He died while he was in detention. And as I said off the top, anti-war candidate and political veteran Boris Nadezhdin has been disqualified, despite his team saying they have enough signatures, they have the support. What is Putin afraid of?
I think Putin is genuinely afraid of any kind of opposition. He has allowed many people in the past to challenge him in small, insignificant ways, but anyone that poses a genuine threat to his power, he wants to control and put down. And I think Yevgeny Prigozhin and Alexei Navalny were probably the two biggest threats to him. And that's why we've seen what has happened with the two of them. You know, President Putin is a strongman leader. He wants to show that he has absolute control over the country. He sends very clear messages about that, saying that anybody who challenges him will do so at their own peril. You know, obviously he has a huge amount of power and arguably doesn't need to control the situation as much to the extent that he does. But I think that the fact that he has been involved in those kind of situations where we've seen these people die does show that there is certainly some fear, some concern that there is perhaps a threat to his leadership. That said, when it comes to the election itself, you know, when we see the candidates who are on the ballot paper, the Communist Party, the Nationalist Liberal Democrat Party, the New People Party, all of those managed opposition candidates, none of them really kind of pose any challenge to him. They're all parties that, despite some nominal differences in policy from the ruling United Russia Party, tend to vote with the ruling party when it comes to any kind of really substantial legislation going through parliament. So ultimately, things just fly through the parliament. There is no scrutiny in the same way that we would see in other countries. And having that kind of complete power does give President Putin the freedom to make choices like invading Ukraine, which, you know, for many people would have been very unpopular and a very unlikely decision. We saw, you know, experts, analysts, voices inside and outside of Russia insisting that that wasn't going to happen, insisting that it was such a unlikely scenario, such a risky scenario for President Putin that it couldn't possibly be something that he would opt to do. And of course, they were all proven wrong in February 2022. So I think we see him expanding his mandate, seeing that having this kind of total control allows him to take those decisions that probably would have otherwise been very unpopular. And in his recent Federal Assembly address to the two houses of Russia's parliament, he insisted that in the case of Ukraine, he was going to outlast his opponents.
We have to take some action, including military action. But today, Ukraine virtually produces or manufactures nothing. They have been trying to maintain their manufacturing capability, but, you know, actually they have been importing things for free. Freeloading, but, you know, it will come to an end sooner or later. Well, they will keep receiving some aid, but, you know, the extermination, the annihilation continues.
Military power is never far from his mind, and some say that is what's driving the growing closeness between him and North Korean leader Kim Jong-un. There are all sorts of reports, Julia, of Pyongyang making arms for Moscow to fight Kyiv, even possibly in exchange for aid and for food. How do you see that particular relationship evolving?
In a friendly one for a while. I was in Vladivostok a few years ago when Kim Jong-un arrived by armored train to meet President Putin. We saw them meet again last year. And, you know, it is really a kind of relationship of convenience, each one getting something that they see as useful from the other. Of course, it's a relationship with that is, you know, triggering a lot of concern in certain circles, not least the United States, which, as you mentioned, has accused North Korea of providing artillery and ammunition to Russia to help support the war effort in Ukraine. They've also been warning that there is a risk in the opposite direction, that in exchange, it's not just food and aid that North Korea is getting from Russia, but possibly even technological know-how that could be helping with its nuclear program. Now, that's something that is really causing a lot of concern as people watch this relationship develop. You know, we saw the Sergei Shoigu has been meeting with Kim Jong-un as well in Vladivostok. He's the Russian defense minister. They were talking about defense and security cooperation. Now, Russia has denied that it's getting any kind of weaponry from North Korea, but it's impossible to know given the secretive nature of that relationship. And what it does really for the Russian government is it gives President Putin more options. Mm. North Korea may not be a particularly popular ally, but certainly it is a country that it was willing to do business with Russia, that has a potential market for Russian goods. And that is certainly allowing President Putin to kind of widen the base of Russian exports. We've also seen that there is a kind of atmosphere of countering the United States. Both countries have a very difficult relationship with Washington, and coming closer together really puts pressure on that perspective from the U.S. and what President Putin often describes as the unipolar world order that he says he's desperately trying to counter.
It sounds like we're talking about friends, you know, relationships. We all need friends, and Russia has China. And I was doing research for this episode, and I came across a clip of President Putin where he explains the dynamic, the closeness of the two countries. Listen to this. This is Mr. Putin speaking to American journalist Tucker Carlson.
China and us are neighbors. You can't choose neighbors or relatives. We share a border with them, 100 kilometers. We are used to one another, and we have been around for centuries in terms of our coexistence. And the foreign affairs philosophy of China is not aggressive. They search for compromise and a trade-off, and the volume of cooperation in trade keeps growing.
So, Julia, how do you see Vladimir Putin's relationship with China evolving and developing if he continues to be president for the next decade?
Well, famously, just before President Putin announced the full-scale invasion of Ukraine, he was in Beijing for the Winter Olympics, where Russia and China declared what they called the No Limits Partnership. And the fact that that happened so close to the time of the invasion was, you know, considered to be very significant. Many questions were asked about whether Xi Jinping knew what was about to happen, whether he had tacitly agreed to it or approved it. We also know that, of course, China has publicly not taken sides. It insists that it is neutral when it comes to the war in Ukraine. But of course, its voting at the UN suggests that it is leaning towards supporting Russia. And also, it's a really fruitful economic relationship for both countries. Russia has been desperately looking for any country that it can do business with in the wake of Western sanctions. It is trying to find new markets, new buyers for its oil and gas. And China represents a really important part, a piece of the puzzle for Russia. You know, in 2022, China accounted for nearly 30% of Russian exports and 40% of its imports. So it's a really big relationship and it's growing ever bigger. Trade finally exceeded the target of $200 billion annually last year, reaching $240 billion. And that was a target that the two countries had been aiming for quite some time. But ultimately, this is a pretty imbalanced relationship at the moment. It's always been this way to a certain extent, but no more so than now. Russia's really dependent on China. China holds most of the cards. China has a lot more options. It's kind of being a lot more strategic in terms of its rhetoric. It's not taking sides, at least visibly. And it has really got the upper hand. It is exacting some of its economic clout on Russia and getting more out of the relationship, particularly in the form of cut priced gas. We obviously saw Europe cut itself off from Russian gas in the wake of the invasion. That was a really big moneymaker for the Kremlin, for its domestic coffers. China has really helped compensate for that loss, but it's doing so at a discount, really. But ultimately, going forward, how that relationship develops, it will continue to develop. We will continue to see President Putin and Xi Jinping meeting and talking about this friendship that they share, the closeness of their countries, the fact that they're trying to create a multipolar world order. But I think there are certainly limits to this no-limit friendship.
A really big story that we covered was the death of Alexei Navalny. And we saw pictures coming out of Moscow, thousands of people chanting his name as he was laid to rest. And he was actually previously asked in a documentary what his message to supporters would be if he died. And he said, very simply, they were not allowed to give up. Could this presidential election provoke unrest, Julia, given it's happening so soon after the death of someone that many consider to be a hero?
It certainly could. I think a lot of people think the timing of Navalny's death was actually intended to send a message right ahead of the elections, that it wasn't a coincidence. That depends who you ask. But there is certainly a risk. Obviously, there has been a huge crackdown in Russia on political protests. Any kind of dissent is criminalized. You can't criticize the war. You can't criticize the government. It certainly is a really perilous place to make your opposition known. So the protests that we've seen over the last couple of years have been really limited. And pretty much everybody who takes part in them is punished in some way. But what was interesting was that at the funeral of Alexei Navalny on March 1st, there were tens of thousands of people lining up at the church to say farewell to someone that they considered to be a hero. You know, Alexei Navalny has a mixed reputation in Russia. Not everybody supports him, even if they were opposition-minded. But there are many people who really did want him to become the next president of Russia. And the queues of people we saw outside that church, outside that cemetery, were not met with any kind of difficulty from the police. They were allowed to gather there. There was a huge police presence, but it didn't interfere. That said, since then, there have been some arrests. We understand from one human rights group, OVD Info, which has always monitored protests and helped protesters with legal troubles afterwards. They say that 113 people were arrested in 19 cities across Russia on the day of the funeral. And there have also been reports in some Russian language opposition publications outside of Russia that people have been identified on security cameras for taking part in that funeral, kind of paying their respects, that have then since been challenged under the law. So there have been repercussions. As to what could happen on election day, we've seen now Alexei Navalny's widow, Yulia Navalnaya, calling for people to protest on the last day of voting. It's a three-day-long election, something else that has been criticized by observers. But on the Sunday, the 17th, Navalnaya has called on anyone who wants to protest Navalny's death, protest Putin's tightening grip on power, to turn up at their polling stations at noon. Of course, there are 11 time zones in Russia. Noon will be different in every one of them. But for all of them to arrive at noon, either to cast their ballots, they can cast their ballots, she said, for anybody that they see fit. They could write Navalny's name on the ballot paper. They could just stand in the polling station as a kind of protest. And she insists that this is a good form of protest because the government certainly doesn't want to prevent people from going to polling stations. She's hoping to see quite a big turnout. There is certainly a risk to that as well, but it's a sort of unorthodox form of protest that she is planning, and it will be really interesting to see how successful that is against the backdrop of a really repressive situation inside Russia. But undoubtedly, we are going to see pretty heavy security, and if there is any kind of wider protest out on the streets, then there will inevitably be a crackdown.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see if people pick up Navalnaya's call to action. You know, we recently had Ukraine's ambassador to Singapore, Katerina Zelenko, come into studio. She spoke to us, and when she was here, we asked her, why should the world even care about what happens between Russia and Ukraine? And she said, to answer that question, you just need to ask yourself, do you want to live in a world where might is right? Julia, how would you answer that question? Why should we care about Russia and what happens in this election?
I don't think the world needs to care about the process of the elections. I don't think that that is necessarily in itself important. But I think the outcome, even if it is predetermined, does certainly have ramifications, because every presidential election that Putin wins, legitimately or otherwise, emboldens him. And I think the longer he is in power, this will be, when he wins, become his fifth term of six. And he has been extending those terms. He's been rewriting the constitution to allow him to run again when he wouldn't have otherwise been able to. The longer he is in power, the more he appears to feel that he has carte blanche to act the way that he wants to. He points to having a big mandate. He says, you know, look how successful I've been politically. This is what the Russian people want, despite the fact that he knows perfectly well that it isn't a free and fair election. And we've seen time and again his imperialist mindset, you know, very much borne out in the invasion of Ukraine and his goal to take back cities like Odessa and Kiev, which were once part of the Russian Empire. We've also seen him stoke unrest in Georgia as well. He certainly has ambitions to expand the scope of the Russian borders. He annexed not only Crimea, but parts of mainland Ukraine, which are going to be voting in the presidential elections because he has taken them into the umbrella of Russia. So that is certainly, I think, of concern. You know, the longer he stays in power, the more elections that happen, the more he will feel empowered to go even further in his actions. And I think that has consequences for the entire world. And I think for the wider world, the longer that President Putin is in power, the more dangerous he certainly can become.
You know, talking to you for the past 20 or so minutes, it's very clear you're passionate about this country. You know a lot about this country. And I'm curious if you have any plans to return to Moscow anytime soon.
I am full of plans, but they're all sort of fictional. At the moment, I don't have any plans to go back anytime soon. I would love to. Not a day goes by that I don't think about Russia, and it's usually with a pang of longing. I miss it very much. And I think at this point in time, given my profession, given some personal circumstances as well, I think it is too risky. But I hope there will be a time when Russia becomes a more open country, when it becomes less dangerous, not just for foreign journalists, but for the Russian people themselves. And I hope that it can stop seeing enemies all around it. It would be naive to say that I'm certain that will happen, but for now, it remains a hope.
Julia, thank you so much for sharing your experiences with me and also for setting the scene for what Russians are facing as polls open on March the 15th.
Thanks very much for having me.
Catch reports from all our correspondents on CNA's YouTube channel and CNA.Asia. And a reminder that the TV episodes of CNA Correspondent air every Wednesday at 9:30 p.m. The tea behind this week's episode is Saya Win, Clara Ong, Crispina Robert, Craig Dale, and myself, Teresa Tang. Thanks very much for joining us.